Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Richard Blanco, who's written a memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos. Richard Blanco is primarily known as a poet, 5 books of poetry. He was one of the poets, or the poet at President Obama's re-inaugural, giving a poem there. Cuban, born in Madrid, came over, lived in New York till the age of 4, wound up outside of Miami. A memoir usually tells a story, whereas what this is a series of short stories, 4 or 5 short stories, about growing up Cuban, trying to deal with being gay at a very early age and not quite succeeding. So let me start by asking, what prompted you to write prose?
At first, it was just a creative curiosity. I mean, I had published all these books of poetry, and I thought, well, what can I do next? And in some ways, always keeping it fresh, as they say. But also, there were so many stories that I wanted to tell, so many backstories that the poems couldn't hold. For example, the first chapter about the infamous Easy Cheese. It's hard to write about Easy Cheese in a poem. So there was so much more background that I wanted to unpack, and I found myself having a great time doing that. So in some ways, you know, because of the compression of poetry, and poetry served as this sort of emotional outline. The Prince of Los Cocuyos is the first half of my first book of poetry, emotionally. And so it was so delightful to be able to, you know, really round out characters like my grandmother and my mother and really dive into them and really examine more slowly and more at length all those little fine details of what was happening throughout those years, delivered in a different way. And I feel like I've learned how to play another instrument, even though it might be a very similar tune.
When you're talking about writing poetry, how much narrative can you put in poetry?
My poetry can be very narrative. Probably, you know, 80% of it is pretty narrative. But even so, you know, poetry always has to have, even when you do a whimsical or humorous poem, it always has to have that sort of compression, that turn, that right at the end that kind of gets you. It can't end on the punchline, so to speak. But poetry, even though it's narrative, it's not driven by narrative. In other words, it's never, as I was instructed, the one basic, really fundamental difference with poetry is that poetry is not plot-driven. You know, you don't read a poem to find out what the end is, necessarily, even though it could be very narrative, and even though it could have that sort of story-like quality. Whereas, I think with prose, one of the hardest things in writing this memoir was to leave the poet at bay a little bit, because you can't go on for 3 pages describing the plastic vinyl on the furniture, which fascinates me still, you know, clear plastic, including the cushions as well. So you had to move on, you know. I had to keep on asking myself, what happens next? What happens next? Who walked into the room? Who said what? Where did we go from there? You know, and sort of keep the action moving in a way that became more storytelling in the traditional sense.
One of the comments I wrote in my notes was, how do you tamp down the poetry? And that's exactly what you're talking about here.
Yeah, and I became sort of a poetry sniper. I would just, like, come in at certain moments and then, you know, for a paragraph, maybe to bring in the poetry where it needed it, and especially at the very end, which is one of the moments I'm most proud of, where I unleashed the poet right at the last 3 pages. And in some ways, it's because I had, in some ways, become that poet already, in a way, psychologically. But, yeah, just how to restrain that and use it where most needed, and use it hopefully at exactly the right times. There were several ways of solving the memoir, which I think we're still trying to solve. What is memoir, right, in that sense? So is it this sort of fluid, poetic, dense stuff that can happen? You know, and that was another hard thing, is always, in my case, because this is from young childhood memories, to not make it too dense and not over-editorialize, because you are writing as an adult knowing or suspecting what all these experiences were, but you don't need to say that. You just need to sort of show what happened and put the pieces together. And one of the things I also wanted to do was, I think in episodes, and I think it's from my fascination with, as you know in the book, with the 30-minute sitcom, you know, the Brady Bunch, the I Love Lucy's.
The Blanco Bunch.
I think in 30-minute intervals, you know. And I didn't want to write that memoir also that sort of has this long sort of arc about, and then in 19 so, and then in 19 so. But I wanted almost each chapter to stand individually, that you could pluck it out of the book almost and still have its own small arc of development, and yet together in the aggregate create a larger arc.
Richard Blanco, is it chronological?
You know, that's one of the things I resisted, and it's a great question, and that no one's actually sort of noticed that I don't give dates. And
no,
I,
you don't.
And I don't.
Or ages.
Or ages. I had to do a spreadsheet. The engineer in me, like, had to do the spreadsheet to equate ages and episodes. So it is loosely chronological, but what interests me is the psychological age. And so why I resisted that, and I think it worked. I would hope that it worked. You know, if you say, I was 8 years old, that means specifically something to the reader, right? And I didn't want people to have that prejudice of what their 8 years old meant versus my 8 years old.
And the same with the difference in age between you and your brother. It may be mentioned. I don't think it is.
No, I don't think I do. I just say it in my readings. We're about 6 years apart, and it's interesting because I always say I think statistically it's the worst age to have two boys apart who are just, you know, horrible. And the other interesting thing about that is that I don't think in ages either. In my spreadsheet, I had to do grade. So if you tell me, oh, I was in second grade, I know what that means to me psychologically. During those years, you just think in terms of grade. I know exactly who I was in the fifth grade. I don't know how old I was in the fifth grade. Honestly, if you ask me right now, I have no idea how old I was in the fifth grade.
Probably 10.
Probably, if you've done the math.
We also don't necessarily know the age of your grandparents or your parents either.
Right.
What we do know is how long you have been there and more or less coming to Miami. Let's get into the meat of this, which is really the story of being the child of Cuban immigrants. And what I found in reading The Prince of Los Cocuyos is that it's not that different from being a second generation anything.
Yes, that's a very good point. And it's not that different from just being a child, period. I think there's this misunderstanding. I suspect that there might be this misunderstanding or misfiring that children of immigrants grow up loving being children of immigrants, that we just love eating pork on Thanksgiving as Cubans. And it's just a plain old generational issue, right? Whatever your parents do is immediate grounds for rejection, whether you're Cuban, whether you came over on the Mayflower, whatever the case is. So there's an initial sort of rejection of that culture that you're inherited with because you're like, that's tacky. Like, oh, you're listening to salsa? We're listening to AC/DC. We're not listening to that tacky stuff. And that's one of things that I think it is universal amongst all immigrant groups, that sort of negotiation and initial sort of rejection. And then as the book goes through, you know, part of the arc of what I wanted to develop is how you come in contact with that heritage. As I say, I learned to be Cuban, or I learned to fall in love with my heritage slowly, and it was a process of maturing and realizing that your parents aren't that crazy and that there is this real place named Cuba, that it isn't some stupid story they keep on telling all the time, like, you know, in your day, you know, went uphill, you know, in the snow 9 miles to walk to school, that kind of feeling that your parents give you about these stories about Cuba was this and Cuba was that. It's like, yeah, whatever, you know. So I just wanted to be American, you know. I wanted to follow all my mythical America. Yeah, in a way, that's a universal thing that many immigrant groups go through. But in even in a larger universal context, it's also the feeling of being the oddball, right? What child hasn't felt like the oddball? Who has not had a dysfunctional Thanksgiving? You don't have to be Cuban to have or an immigrant to have a dysfunctional Thanksgiving. I've always operated and written even my poetry from the understanding, from the belief that no matter how the scenery changes, that the core emotional common human denominators are really what I'm after. You know, I try to be as specific as possible, but of course, the irony of the universality comes in that specificity.
You've got a long sequence, one of the stories about your trip to Disney World, in which you, as the child, no different from me as the child or any other child, wanting to meet Mickey Mouse and maybe wanting to hang out with Sleeping Beauty's castle is a little much, but that's pretty standard. What isn't standard, though, is your mother planning to do all the cooking in the hotel room.
Right. Yeah, and packing that gun. Well, you know, food is obviously big in my poetry. For several reasons. One was a very sort of socioeconomic reason, right? You know, we want to be prepared so we don't have to buy food and spend money on eating out and all that kind of stuff. But it's also comfort food in the real sense of the word. I mean, there was no, in 1970-something, there was nowhere to get little Cuban coffee somewhere in Orlando. Driving to Disney World back then and leaving Miami city limits was literally like going into another country for us. And so the idea of having your food was also sort of a way of feeling protected and at home, and everything will be all right as long as we have Cuban coffee and Jadito sandwiches and all the rest. So there's layers to that. But and we were, of course, terribly embarrassed. We wanted to eat cheeseburgers and, you know, and French fries and buy everything. And like, it's very different in that way.
But not that different, again, if I had friends with immigrant Jewish parents going down to Disney World with them, they would, you know, it would be the same thing. And they'd be going, oh, my God, I need to get away from these people as quickly as I can. You know? But somewhere along the line, of course, you do, not necessarily in the Prince of Los Cocuyos, but a little bit, you do begin to recognize your Cuban heritage. I mean, yeah. It's no longer just a complete embarrassment.
Yeah, and I think and that's exactly, you know, where all that happens, and hence the title of the book, Los Cucuyos, which means loose translation means fireflies, is at my uncle's grocery store, which is named El Cucuyito, and that's where it really starts happening. So that's where the other countercurrent, you know, all the while little Ricky, you know, searching for that mythic America and sort of trying to run away from his crazy Cuban family and thinking, I want to just be as American as Peter Brady. Or Marsha Brady, in my case, but there at the store is a real turning point, right? Because suddenly he's surrounded by the customers and the employees and the family, and that's where the countercurrent starts along the way. He's realizing and coming in contact, wait, this Cuba thing isn't just some story. This is really part of who I am and part of my life. As happens as you mature, you know, adding, really dimensioning what it is all your parents were saying and what this community is constantly babbling about, and really realizing this is real, and this is in some ways very important to who I am and or will be. As you said, the book takes you right to the sort of the cliff. You know, this is eventually why I started writing poetry, is because of that very question, and because of that search, and because of that yearning to reconnect, to reclaim, and understand everything that had been happening all along.
Richard Blanco, as you were speaking, you suddenly switched to the third person and talking about little Ricky.
Yeah.
Why?
I do. I'm surprised it took me this long to switch. because I think, and I don't know if that comes from the poetry. Very, very good question that nobody else has ever asked me either. In poetry, you especially tend to think of yourself, of the I as a persona of yourself. You realize that in a poem, is not the same guy who's, you know, stuck in traffic and, like, cussing at the guy that just cut him off, that there's a persona and a voice, a very distinct part of your psyche that is the person in the poem. And I think the same happened for me in the memoir. And it does feel like another person, another dimension of me. And it's easier to, in some ways, to discuss it that way, because it's not verbatim the same person that's sort of sitting right in front of you right now. It's part of me that's been thought out, part of me that's really dug deeper into parts of my mind and is not just sort of going about life, having lunch and drinking coffee.
What's the difference between a grocery store and a bodega?
It's a problem with Spanish in the New World. Bodega in Spain means actually wine cellar. And somehow in the Caribbean Spanish, not even in Central or South American Spanish, but in Caribbean Spanish, it's come to mean a little grocery store. So it's not a big supermarket. It's just kind of a mom-and-pop shop. Some tend to be a lot smaller or bigger. It depends on the size. El Cocuyito is pretty big size for a Cuban bodega. Some of them will have cafeterias, as did my uncle's, and they sell Cuban coffee and pastries and sometimes full lunches and all this stuff, and the whole place smells like pan con bistec, like Cuban steak sandwiches. And then the rest is, you know, plain old mini version, sort of a convenience store, maybe a little bit larger.
You take great pains to use the word bodega.
It's also one of those words that I resist translating because it's so ethnically attached to me. So you'd always say, vamos a la bodega. You know, you wouldn't say, let's go to so-and-so. You knew what la bodega mean. Even in New York, people just, you know, it's the closest one right in the neighborhood, you know, that vamos a la bodega. Let's go to the store, you know. So that way it is very attached to me. And hence the Prince idea also comes into play in the title. it does become like this focal center of the community. And I think that still happens in many cities. It's, hey, Juan, come on. You know, like, they'll spend hours talking over, you know, a little thimble-sized cup of coffee. It's more than just getting your food and doing your groceries. It's the gossip. It's the meeting ground for the whole sort of community to come and share news, pictures. I mean, they'd bring in pictures to show me about family. I mean, they'd just tell me stories. It was family. It was an extended form of sort of a village. And that became very important to me. It's a very, very, very big part of my life. I ended up working there until I think I was 21. At first, as you know, in the book, I was like, ugh, I don't want to work here. Like, and then later on, beyond the memoir, I would go because I needed to go there. And it wasn't for the money. And it was, I needed those people in my life. I needed to continue being part of them and them being part of me.
Richard Blanco, what's a Florida room?
That was one of the hardest things with the editor that we just couldn't wrap our heads around. I thought it was just common knowledge, so I just write a Florida room. There's a poem in my third book called El Florida Room, just because I wanted to explain that to everyone. So it's sort of like a family room. But it's usually something at the end of the house, so it's sort of a peninsula at the end of the house, usually that you add on afterwards as you know, it's an addition, usually just surrounded on all three sides by windows, and sometimes even just screened in. They can call that a Florida room. It is the bodega of the house. It's the place where everything happens, where the family gathers. And we're talking about small houses where, you know, the living room was never to be sat in. It had the plastic clear vinyl on the furniture and the velvet curtains. That wasn't the room that was to be used. So the Florida room, it became that space for the family. It's where most of my memories were made.
In that room.
Yeah.
Speaking of the plastic, you know, I would go over to friends' houses in Clearview in Queens, and their parents had plastic on the living room furniture, and my mom never did. And I used to wonder, don't they realize that if they sit there, how horrible it is? They never take the plastic off, and there's no reason to have it on.
If you look at the show Everybody Loves Raymond, the mother has everything in plastic. It's this idea of preserving what we have, of being proud of it. You don't want it to be destroyed. You know, it's like the first, like, brand new living room furniture that we brought, and it better last forever because, one, we don't have any money to buy a new one. But this idea of a showpiece, but it's just completely impractical. I mean, you can imagine in Florida, and we couldn't put on the air conditioner only at night to save money. So you can imagine sitting in, like, 98-degree, 99% humidity, trying to sit in a vinyl when you get up and your skin just peels off of it. But yet, it's sort of one of the kookiest and fondest weird memories that we have of that whole world. As a kid, again, you're going like, you guys are crazy. You know, like, and now you can look back on it and, like, and now you can have a laugh at it.
Richard Blanco, your parents came from Cuba. Your grandparents came from Cuba. They had very specific political ideas about Cuba. And the Cubans in Miami, because they left Cuba for whatever reason, were always very anti-Castro. How has that changed? What's changed? And if it hasn't, how do you reconcile your own politics with their politics?
Yeah. I just sort of want to backtrack a little bit so that everyone can understand that even within the Cuban community, there's always a spectrum of what that means, right? So Cubans get this reputation for being that right-wing. Right-wing didn't even exist back then, but, you know, that sort of very conservative Republican. And, of course, historically, that has to deal with the Bay of Pigs invasion as well. It's not just an anti sort of Castro sentiment. It also had to do with that moment in history that sort of tip the scales, but it's also only one sector of the population. Also realize that my parents came in 1968, not in 1959 or 1960. So my parents weren't actually lower. My mother grew up in a dirt floor home. There's so many layers of what that immigration means and different ways and perspective depending on when you came, what you feel about it. So my parents weren't too polarized. I mean, yes, certainly they felt that SOB, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they did give it a chance, and they made a decision full 10 years after the revolution. You know, and in some ways it was more of a American dream thing decision versus just political ideology or running because they had to go because right. You were, you know, in a revolution. You know who's first to get their heads chopped off. So, and that certainly was a real threat to the very early waves of Cuban immigrants. So it has changed for several reasons. One is, of course, that older generation from the very early 60s is dying off. Number two is there's been so many other waves of Cubans in Miami that aren't even necessarily care about the politics. You know, when we're talking about the Mariette, the boat lift, the wave of the rafters, now there's still all my cousins that used to live in Cuba of my generation live in Miami now. And they have different perspectives. Their perspectives are more about a brighter future and economic gain and the American dream story versus that SOB kind of thing. So it's changed because of that. Miami-Dade County was a blue county this year, which was shocking to me. I always like to say, in Miami, when I was announced, when the announcement came out that I was for Obama's inaugural poet, I was a little bit, you know, apprehensive. Well, they went all out. I mean, Miami was just overjoyed and just wonderful. There was, as far as I know, there was no negative sort of commentary about anything about that from politicians or anything, because blood maybe is thicker than water. And I always like to say, if I would have been Bush's inaugural poet, they would have shut down the city. I mean, I can't imagine. It was crazy to begin with. What else also happened, and this is what I think has also happened, Miami has become much more cosmopolitan, or I should say pan-Latino. And so groups like Venezuelans, a lot of Venezuelan, Colombian, Brazilian, have gone into the mix and have affected sort of the political perspectives because they come with other perspectives and that wash, not wash away, but sort of changes the mix. And I think that old rhetoric of, you know, we're not going back, this kind of, you know, it's kind of a little passe already, actually, even in Miami. I mean, you still have a few voices that claim to speak for everybody else, sort of feeling. But you go to Miami International Airport on any given day, and you tell me if there's an embargo or not. You know, I mean, the communication and the travel between, it's not free travel, but those, it's just constantly more and more connection with Cuba and a sense of almost a reunification in a way. I mean, my cousins get here, and in 8 months to a year, they have residency. They hop back on a plane, go see their family. The family comes over here every few years. There's a whole different dynamic going on now. It isn't that, you know, that great invisible great wall that was put up in the 60s.
So people get out, but once they're out, they get residency. They can go back and forth.
You have to apply for a visa and all the rest. But now it's actually more lax than ever. You can't just buy a ticket on Orbitz, obviously, and you have to go through a couple weeks of a visa obtaining process, and there has to be a specific reason. In my case, I mean, if you have family there, that's one of the big check boxes where you get to go. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Yeah, there's a constant sort of communication, and it's done a lot to create a new kind of Cuban culture in Miami that is not them and us. What the experiences in the island and what the experiences in Miami is a much more shared experience now.
Well, when you go back to Cuba, I mean, at first, from friends of mine who've gone, they said it was very much like walking back into 1959,
yep.
I mean, Havana. Has that begun to change?
As far as I know, no. And I haven't been in like 6 years. You know, that a lot has to do because of the economics and, you know, to build new things, you need new investment and all the rest. And but what's really great and what's really interesting about that, which is really screws with your mind, like the very first time I went to Cuba, you know, it was like stepping back in time, but even more so because of what surrounded you, you know, because of Cuba, what it is. My grandfather's house was still there. It wasn't a strip mall. The tiles of my grandmother's house was still the same tiles that she used to talk about. All the stories and the relatives and the house and all these other, the sugar mill that they worked at and all that. And it's like literally stepping into a time machine. And it's a wonderful, it really screws with your mind, but it's a wonderful sort of really reenacting the past of your parents, and it's so powerful emotionally. Unfortunately, I think the circumstances that create that, it's the good side of sort of a weak economy, I guess.
Well, I remember when my friend told me about what Havana's like, I kept thinking, you know, like we have a perfectly preserved Prague of a certain era and a perfectly preserved Havana, and it would be a shame, even though it might be great economically, to let that go, because we do have this incredibly preserved 50-year-old, or well, crumbling, but preserved in another way, 50-year-old
city. At least
there,
yeah. Well, that's a shame that it's that's part of it is that, I mean, I've not been to Prague, but But it's getting to a critical point, because without the investment to restore these things, it won't work. Part of, and this is where sort of my engineer and city planner comes in, and that kind of interest in to see things happen. There's this sort of irony that, and it happens a lot sort of in New England towns as well. It's like, well, we don't want outside investment, or we don't want this town to be a resort town because we want to preserve it. Well, the idea is control the investment to get the money to preserve it. And so I think there's been this fear. But what I fear is that from in, 24 hours, all that could just completely turn on its head. And then you're going to see the bulldozers come through. Because if you don't control it and you don't envision it and plot it out and get, basically strategically to have the means and the economic investment to be able to preserve what you want to preserve. And, that's my fear. When people say, oh, I want to go to Cuba before it changes, it's kind of an insult in some ways to me. I'm like, what do you mean? Before it changes what? Before people have more freedoms? Or like, what are you talking about? And I know what they mean, but at the same time, it's this careful balance. And if you hold on too tightly, then the collapse could just be devastating, right?
I mean, the Castros are old, and we know that over in Eastern Europe, 1 year, 1989, whammo, could happen.
Yeah. That's usually the way things happen, don't they? and that's my fear, because I want, if something does happen, I want the Cuban people from Cuba to maintain, it's just the whole point of the revolution, right, to reclaim the island and its prosperity for the people. And what I'd hate to see happen is to sort of because of a kind of a chaos that then, and I think there are people already lined up to sort of, come in there. I want that prosperity and that economy to be for, I would wish, not want, I can want a million things. I wish that wealth and that prosperity happens from the inside out, not from the outside in.
Richard Blanco, the other subtext beside Cuba in your book, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, is trying to deal with being a gay kid, particularly in a very, very macho Latino society. Is it getting better now?
Yeah, in general, in the same ways that Miami has matured or my Cuban community has sort of changed in different ways. Sometimes even my mom, it's a point of embarrassing sometimes. Sort of she's outing everybody in the family, especially the ones from Cuba. And she's like, oh, you didn't know? She's like, yeah, even his wife says he is, And that's a very telling thing, which is one of the things I wanted to bring out in the book, is the brand of homophobia that is particular to not just Cubans, but in general the Latino sensitivity it's a sticky issue in any culture, basically. It's, universally a sticky issue. But what I came to discover and think about in the memoir was that if you really look at my grandmother, who was the central sort of homophobic character, the homophobia, the brand of it, it's not this kind of that's against God and you're going to hell and you're damned forever, which is more of an Anglo sort of, at least what we see in parts of our country today, that kind of defense. But rather, it was the real crime was being effeminate. And in there, you get the play of machismo, which is so much a fabric of Latino societies in general, cultures and groups. And so if you really look carefully at my grandmother's character, all she's trying to do is make me into a man, but not a straight man necessarily. She knows what's coming down the pike.
Well, I think she says at one point that it's better to be a masculine gay man than an effeminate straight man.
And that captures it perfectly. It's easier said in Spanish. It says, es mejor serlo y no parecerlo que no serlo y parecerlo, which means it's better. Let me see if I get this right. It's more honorable to be gay but not appear to be gay, in other words, be macho, than the other way around, than be effeminate and yet you're not gay. Like she used to say this all the time. I also wanted to sort of let people know that and in some ways how I can feel, in some ways I feel more connected in a way to a group of gay Latino men than I would to a group of gay, for lack of a better word, Anglo men, though that might mean Polish and that might mean a million other things. But because there's another layer of connection, right? And that all these stories, all these hats I wear, first gay, first Latino, first immigrant, first engineer, that all those hats are really one big hat, one big sombrero, if you will, and that all those stories happen simultaneously, and all those things inform each other. So my sense of who I am as a gay man has to do with who I am as a Cuban man, and that I can't pull those things apart completely. And the same idea how that kind of sexuality affected, or that brand of homophobia affected, my career choices. I had to hide my colorings from my grandmother and my little gay things that I would do. You know, the arts weren't something supported by her, but it was also a kind of xenophobia as well. If there were things she didn't understand to her, if I would have studied English, that would have been queer, not gay, but queer. And where was the line between that being about sexuality and that just being about xenophobia? And I just became really interested in all those layers of what would become is this unique recipe, you know, of a cup of this and a dash of that and a pinch of this and a teaspoon of the other. They all happen at the same time, and they all affect each other. They all inform each other. They converge. They collide. They complement. They diverge. It all happens together.
I remember when I was first dealing with the issues in me, one of the things that happened is I became, I don't want to say fearful, but it was like when I'd see effeminate gay men, oh, no, that's not me. That's not me. You know, I'm going to go to a baseball game. Was that even more severe for you, or were you more accepting?
No, I had the same. The first person that was sort of, I don't think he was acting, but a straight behaving, I don't even know what the right word is, gay man is in the grocery store.
Right, that guy.
Right, with Victor. And that was like an eye-opener. It was like, oh, my God, you're not prancing around like what my grandmother thinks gay is, because she would make fun of this or make fun of that. And so that it just completely feminine thing became, again, the crime. And then that was equated to being gay. And I was like, but wait a minute. This guy doesn't act that way. And it was my first when my eyes opened and said, oh, my God, like, that isn't gay. And then this other layer, which is interesting in machismo culture, right, which is this sort of over-masculine, or this heightened sense of masculinity, right? Which the irony of that is that there's this other undercurrent of a complete homoerotic sense. It's almost Greek in its scale, right? And then this other irony that it's all about the men, and the men, and the men hold the power and all this stuff, and the men protect the women, and the women, worst insult you could tell a Latino guy is calling him a son of a bitch or say something about his sister. The women are all this sort of female protecting culture, yet female reviling in a way, you know. And of course, who holds all the cards, really? The women. So, like, you know, and that's the story of my grandmother and my mother, who are arguably the two strongest characters who ran everything, you know. And even my Tia Gloria in the book, her father thinks he's running the store, but she's the one who's the heir apparent, who, like, really knows the business inside out. And so there's all these layers that I think is a little, not necessarily easier or harder than any other culture, just different. You know, the challenges for me as a gay Cuban kid, again, weren't easier or harder. It was just different, and I wanted to highlight that. We have to negotiate perhaps different things.
Well, I think your reaction dealing with girls, dealing with how you kind of go, well, you know, yeah, she can be my friend, I don't want to kiss her. That's pretty standard for most gay kids. I haven't seen that too much in books, because most people don't really talk about what it's like in that way.
That's a very good point, Rich. I mean, one of the things that I knew I didn't want this book to be was a coming out story. And so, again, it just takes you right to the cliff where you know from that moment forward, little Ricky's life as Richard will be all these other things. But one of the things that became very important to me is exactly, I never saw that unique psychology of, and it was one of the hardest things to write. And one of the hardest things working with the editor, and she was amazing, but it was one of the hardest things to sort of get across to her. It was like, as a gay child of that generation and that era, you're not sitting there going, gee, I wonder if next weekend's a good time to come out. The terror and the lack of role models, the wealth of negative stereotypes and negative role models, if you will, is so terrifying that you can't even have that conversation in the deepest recesses of your mind. So it's a way of talking to yourself in code, even in the privacy of your mind, right? And as I say in the book, the best way I could describe it, it was a knowing without knowing. And you just kind of are going through the motions and hoping and thinking and but knowing.
Maybe tomorrow I'll be straight.
Yeah, or like maybe that girl wasn't the one. You know,
right,
like
yeah.
My first kiss in the book with a girl. You know, maybe that, well, it was maybe just because I feel like more. And you know you're lying to yourself. You know you're absolute, but you can't even admit that to yourself. And so when a person comes out, it's really a series of 1,000 little episodes of your life that are really, to me, psychologically more interesting than that actual moment of coming out, because that's really what leads from the moment you're 5 years old and something happens, or my grandmother says something, the challenges, how you push back, how you try to, even in passing or trying to pass, you learn more about yourself. Little pieces, people that come into your life, as Victor and Ariel do in the book, that are sexually more ambiguous, and you're like, wait a minute, what's this, why is this guy touching me that way? You know, what's going on here? Why am I feeling this way? I'm not feeling that way. No, you're not feeling that way. You're just horny, and you just, you know, it has nothing to do with this guy. No. You know, all these justifications and things in your head that you just, one of the hardest things is to write about something that you can't even, you don't even have language for in your head.
Well, there's also the notion that no matter how much you are the Cuban in the family, at the same time, you're also the fish out of water, which means you're the outsider. You know, it gives you a different feeling toward other outsiders, too.
Yeah, and you have a hyper sense of what that outsider feeling. And in my case, it's also the outsider in terms of culturally, right? So,
right.
Like, there's all these layers that I just became interested in. But one of them is, yeah, just knowing that you're different always, and knowing that at the one sense, it's a source of great sort of loneliness and pain. It's also, as you look back at it, a source of great wisdom in a way.
But it also, it also forces you on some level to deal with it in an artistic sense, in a creative sense. You have to find an outlet, and I guess that's where poetry came in for you.
As I always say, in some ways, my grandmother made me a writer. Because of her constant surveillance and all the rest, I became more of a withdrawn child, right? The outsider, the observer. I needed to negotiate my space. I needed to read people emotionally to survive emotionally myself, to not get called un maricón or un pato, you know. And in that process, I think the skills of observation, and what do writers do at the end of the day? They sit around and watch people and write about them, right? And you watch yourself as well. You know, you're constantly aware of human emotions and motivations and human nature. And I think when I turned, finally after engineering and all this stuff, I always knew I wanted to do something creative, which I had denied myself or was denied for me as well. And when that page turned, I said, oh, I'm an engineer. I already got a job. I'm going to do some fun. And I started writing poetry. And suddenly that I realized that was a way to say everything that I couldn't have said, all those years of not being able to speak, so to speak. It was a way to open this channel of communication with the world, and realizing how much I had remembered and how much I had observed, all these memories that were trapped inside of me. And eventually it was writing in a way that also, as I became fairly successful as a poet, that it allowed me to envision myself as a gay man. I was like, well, I can be this poet. And that opened the door to being able to envision myself as a life as an artist. Let me envision myself as a life of a gay artist. And in some ways, all that trajectory, you know, all started here. And it was all those three things, you know, the career choice and the dynamic between being a poet and the artistic thing that was squelched, almost as closeted as my sexuality, because for the same reasons, comes to bear altogether and comes to bloom later on altogether.
And then, Richard Blanco, you become a famous poet and a successful one, which is very rare,
right?
Very rare.
One of the readers told me one time that, and I thought it was a great observation, that when you read this book, you're reading it conscious that this little husky, this little chubby kid from a suburb in Miami with a kooky grandmother and a wonderfully a Moldavar film kind of setting family, and that this kid grows up to do what he was asked to do, and that in some ways it's a great sort of American dream story, as is our president's, as is Obama's, you know, that when you think about his biography and the chances of that ever happening, but there he is, or there he was. And I think that was part of my motivation to finish the book, to let people know that that kind of story, which you really, you're not the sole author of, obviously, but that I didn't just get up there and, you know, that there's a whole background to me. There's a whole crazy, wonderful, funny world that, you know, as I say, most of my life felt like an I Love Lucy episode really gone wrong. Which both parents are human, not just one.
And your little Ricky.
Even Ethel and Fred, which are kind of like my grandparents, they're Cubans. It's like the whole Cuban. That wonderful and beautiful things can happen in life. And I'm sort of Pollyanna in that way. Another sort of comment on the book was that in that same sort of vein, that it's a hopeful book in that sense. Not that it doesn't have its gravitas or moments, but that looking back on one's life and knowing that one perseveres and all these challenges in some ways have a very flippant sort of funny side to them. And if we can't laugh at ourselves and if we can't laugh at some of the struggles that we go through and give them some perspective in a memoir, then where else can we do it, you know?
Richard Blanco, you've written this memoir. Do you plan to write a sequel taking us up to your coming out?
Yes. I'm sort of thinking about it. I need a break, though. But I need to do a book of poetry next. In some ways, as I said, because poetry sort of lays out this emotional outline for me, the next book would have to be, I think, attack it in a different way, a slightly different way, because here there's a lot more storytelling on, because I'm obviously telling stories from being in my childhood, and I don't remember direct dialogue, so there's a much more sort of fable kind of flow. I don't even break up dialogue traditionally how it should be, because I want to let the reader know that these are impressions sort of gathered and put together. So the sequel would be, I have two that I have in my mind. One is my first trip to Cuba, my very first trip to Cuba, which I have to do more memory work, but I hadn't quite come out yet. I was living a closeted gay life. I had made the decision, but I hadn't come out yet. And in one of those episodes, my very first trip to Cuba, my cousins take me to a brothel because they're convinced I'm this straight guy, you know, American, and they can't get into these places unless it's with me as a tourist. You know, they're not allowed into these places. And it's all very harmless, really. And I have no idea where I'm going. I'm just, they call it the club. Well, I won't give it all away, but long story short, by the end of the evening, I'm petrified as my mother and my uncle walk in, and I've never been so embarrassed or so happy to see my mother at the same time, because I was like, I'm not coming out in the middle of Cuba here. I haven't even come out in Miami. So there's a little, and the other layer, the other story would be more about the coming out. And what I found interesting about my life, as if I had scripted it, as South Beach was coming out, so to speak, in many ways, not just sexually, but my life and my maturing parallel, that incredible renaissance and beyond renaissance of what was South Beach. So you have Yetta in this book from the old South Beach. But, you know, as I was becoming, and I'm not sure that I would have come out when I did if it wasn't for the city and how the city and plays such a large role in our lives. So, you know, that whole sort of the gay South Beach, we came out at the same time. I was having a dialogue with the city in a way that was part of the dynamic. And to capture that part of Miami Beach that I think has also moved on. I always like to think of myself as an emotional historian in everything that I do. And that is to record what it feels like to live, to be a human being in a particular place and time, just for the sake of recording that, because history books don't do that. Newspapers don't do that necessarily. It's only art that can really capture that really essential sense of our humanity.
And then one final question. Have you thought about writing fiction?
Yes, I have a wonderful piece from something that happened in Cuba that's been haunting me for about 8 years now. I have the title. I have the dedication. I can see the book in my head. But I'm also wondering if that's part of the second memoir. I don't want to give it all away, but it has something to do with something very tragic that I learned and mysterious at the same time in our family, which they kind of just tell you over dinner. Like, you're like, really? And I wonder if there isn't some kind of – I keep on envisioning – perhaps a memoir / novel, something like In Cold Blood kind of thing, where it's my trying to dig into this, because I still got to dig. I haven't started digging yet, and seeing how all this really did happen and discovering something amazing along the way.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Blanco, whose latest book is The Prince of Los Cocuyos. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.